is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Barry, a guy. We're going to be discussing his review of Dean Baker's Rigged. Barry, a guy, it's great having you back on the show.
As always, it's good to be on.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator.
Hey there.
Hey, how's it going?
So the last time we talked about your review of Michael Hudson's Killing the Host, and you've been doing this whole kind of series where you've been reviewing economic books, and I think it's very crucial because there's not enough economic blogs. I mean, there mm-hmm. are plenty of economic blogs, but I feel that you've had this comment before that a lot of bloggers, they just talk about maybe like immigration nonstop.
Or race, feminism.
Or gender, exactly. Or SJWs. And there's not that much serious enough talk about economics.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love savaging SJWs as much as the next guy. But at the same time, you don't want to be a one-trick pony. And I think that, as I've argued before, economics plays a big role in the cultural degeneracy that people on the alt-right complain about all the time. So I think it's absolutely vital to discuss the pathologies of our current political economy.
And the book is called Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And can you give some background information on Dean Baker?
Well, I'll say this. Dean Baker is one of the few economists I actually trust, and it's a pretty small circle because, like Michael Hudson, Dean Baker was one of the few economists who actually correctly predicted the housing bubble and the potential fallout from its collapse. And I used to read his editorials on Al Jazeera America, and I actually would read parts of his older books, such as The Conservative Nanny State. And Dean Baker, what sort of attracted me to him was the way he was not afraid to go against the grain, because growing up in the liberal Bay Area, at least among everyone I knew, people treated Bill Clinton as this savior who balanced the budget, made the hard decision to cut, to raise taxes, and he was an economic hero. But then Dean Baker came along and said, well, not so fast. And he demolishes that myth completely, among other myths. And so Dean Baker came up with so many good original ideas that even if I disagree with him, he's one of the more respectable economists.
A lot of the criticism of Bill Clinton is about his policies with globalization, NAFTA, granting China favorite nation, mm-hmm. favorite trading status, and his repeal of Glass-Steagall. But on the other hand, a lot of people praise Bill Clinton for balancing the budget. Does Dean Baker actually criticize the budget surplus and conservative fiscal hawks?
Absolutely. Not only does he do that, for like you said, Baker has argued that the point of an economy is not to run budget surpluses, but also even if we do take it for granted that budget surpluses are necessary and good for a healthy economy, Baker points out that the reason why the U.S. accumulated such large budget surpluses was because of the dot-com stock bubble, which conveniently collapsed right after Clinton left office. So once the stock bubble collapsed, then the U.S. economy was plunged into a quagmire where it went through the lowest period of job growth from 01 to 05 since the Great Depression, I believe.
Another anathema to progressives is that the market can be a force for good. Obviously, you don't want monopolies, whether they're private or public monopolies. I think you do want competition, and competition leads to innovation. And there are a lot of progressives who are hesitant to admit that, but Dean Baker actually does and knowledge that markets can be a force for good.
Right. And what he really does is he exhorts us to not just take the market for granted, because you always see these national review types saying that, oh, well, you know, we may be unequal and some people may have more wealth than others, but look, it's the free market. What do you want to do? We're not communists. But as Baker would say, the high earnings of doctors, CEOs, and intellectual property holders, just to name a few examples, have absolutely nothing to do with the free market. And that if we had true free market policies, then the salaries of these people would be significantly reduced.
And that's one of the points you brought up about this article about doctors and highly paid professionals. Obviously, CEOs, bankers, and rentiers are easy targets, but people tend to respect professionals like doctors. And there's sort of that argument that because doctors are providing a valued, crucial service, they deserve a high income. And there's also the argument that going through medical school can be excruciating, and there needs to be economic incentives for that reward. Does he make the case that doctors are overcompensated?
Absolutely. And I forget where this line is from, but, you know, deserve has nothing to do with it. Because, as Baker would likes to say, markets don't care about rationalizations. Protectionism and government intervention by different names still constitute government intervention and protection. And so in the case of doctors, don't get me wrong, I actually have a doctor in my family, my extended family, and, you know, they work hard, they provide a valuable service. I'm not trying to disparage them in any way, but nevertheless, they do make more money than they deserve. And you just look at how American doctors make around twice as much money as doctors in every other first world country. There's no rational economic reason why they make so much money, but rather they have managed to rig the market for themselves in order to ensure that the supply of doctors remains relatively low and that they can collect excessive salaries.
And how do they do that? Are you talking about immigration protectionism? Because I know through the nursing industry, there's a lot of visas for nurses, especially from countries like the Philippines. And with doctors, I know in the public sector, you have a lot of the Medi-Cal doctors are from India. In the public sector, you want healthcare as cheap as possible, so foreign doctors are willing to work for cheaper wages. Is there immigration mm-hmm. protectionism for doctors in the private sector?
Yes, absolutely. And to be clear, there are foreign doctors in the U.S., and I've been serviced by some. But as Baker would say, people would not be foolish enough to argue that there's no protectionism for agriculture just because you can find a few Mexican avocados in a grocery store. And the same logic applies to doctors. And so in the case of doctors, one of the main ways they protect themselves and limit their supply is through the requirement that a doctor must complete an American residency program before he or she can practice medicine. So even if a foreign doctor from, say, Japan were the most qualified doctor in the world, if that doctor were to try to practice medicine in the U.S. without completing a residency, he'd be arrested by the state. So that's protectionism at its finest.
Are there other forms of protectionism other than immigration in the medical industry that drive up the cost?
Yes. So, for example, there are many tasks that nurses and lower-paid medical professionals could easily perform. And in fact, in, say, the 18 to 20 states where nurses are allowed to perform primary care services, patients report high levels of satisfaction. But in most states, doctors are the ones who basically set the standards for care, and nurses and other people cannot perform services unless they go through a doctor. So that's another way they inflate their salaries.
And that's interesting to point out, because that's an argument I've heard. Ron Paul made that argument, and I've heard conservatives and libertarians make that argument. So, I mean, it's kind of like that cliche, like a broken clock is like right twice a day.
Right. And yes, you know me. You know that I generally don't hold the free market in high esteem or libertarianism in high esteem, but what Baker's doing and what I think is clever about his approach is the way he sort of uses these free market libertarian arguments against apologists for the rich, saying that, you know, how can you support inflated doctor pay? What are you, against free markets? And he's sort of, in many ways, highlighting their hypocrisy.
Does he say that soaring income inequality is an inevitable part of the free market, or is it something that is deliberately caused by policies that are implemented to redistribute wealth upwards? And that is similar to the article arguments that Michael Hudson made in Killing the Host.
Right, and it's definitely the latter from Dean Baker's standpoint, because even though I haven't reviewed his book yet, I did read Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, and Piketty basically embraces the former approach. He says that, well, people give rentiers a bad name, but guess what? In any capitalist society, there's always going to be high returns on capital. You know, there's nothing you can do to stop it, so we might as well just tax it away. But people like Baker and Hudson would say, well, wait a minute here. Why is it that the rich are so rich to begin with? What is it about the structure of the market that leads to such high income inequality? And so what people like Baker want to do is change the market, de-rig it in order to ensure that it works for regular people just as much as it does for those at the top.
And one of the other factors with monopoly is a copyright law.
Right, and in many ways, one of the reasons why I was drawn to Baker was because he was the first person who really argued against copyrights as a government-granted monopoly, because for years, I took copyright laws for granted, and one time, one of my friends, who's now a DJ, even told me that he felt bad about illegally downloading music, and he thought it was some sin. But now, having read Baker, I realize that copyright laws are not God-given laws or laws handed down to us by nature. They're conscious policies of the government to incentivize creative work, but that doesn't mean they're necessary or that they're the only way we can incentivize creative work. But putting that aside, regardless of the intent, copyrights do allow their holders to charge large monopoly prices and collect pretty high rents.
And I could understand, like, the individual artist or filmmaker, director, musician owning a copyright, or even be able to pass it on to their descendants, like in a will. But what's going on basically is you have these big corporate conglomerates that buy up all the copyright monopolies.
Right, and it's actually a huge problem for innovation, because what a lot of companies will do is that they'll amass large numbers of patents. Because keep in mind, when a company buys another company and whenever there's a merger, they keep all the patents from both companies. So what these big, giant corporations will do is they'll use their patents and copyrights to thwart would-be competitors, saying, hey, you're infringing on our material. And so it's small wonder that entrepreneurship in the U.S. has, by and large, plummeted.
Common line from neoliberals, libertarians, free market advocates is that today's losers in the global economy simply need to acquire more skills. But the thing is, you have all these people who are overqualified, highly educated, and skilled, and they're still struggling economically.
Right.
They have jobs that are below their skill levels.
Right, and another important thing to note is that, as Ha-Jun Cheng, I didn't mention this in the review, but in his book 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism, Ha-Jun Cheng notes that one of the primary reasons why wages are relatively high in first world countries is because of immigration control. And he even goes so far as to say that if we had truly open borders and a truly free market, then 80 to 90% of workers could be replaced by cheaper foreigners. Because think about it, the U.S. has over 300 million people, but around the world there are tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of bright, energetic, hardworking people who would gladly do the jobs American professionals currently do for far less. So if we did have a true globalized free market, then even the best and brightest meritocrats with skills would be priced out. And yet they're not, because people like Zach Buchamp and Matt Iglesias are by and large protected, so they can advocate for globalization while not enduring its negative effects.
Well, I think the original trend was that immigration was displacing the working class, but now you're starting to see it have a negative effect on the upper class as well, especially their children. And it's interesting to see what's going to happen is traditionally it's been these kind of a dissident populist movements have been movements of the working class. But now throughout history, I mean, the most successful dissident movements have not been movements of the proletariats, but disaffected members
right.
of the aristocracy. And you're seeing mm-hmm. this trend of the children of the upper middle class who are in student debt. They're being negatively affected by a lot of these trends, and some of them are going over to kind of the SJW direction and directing their anger that way. But I'm sure you see a lot of those individuals joining authentic dissident movements.
Right. And don't get me wrong, I don't want anyone's livelihood to be adversely affected by these trends. But I do think that from a political standpoint, it's important that it's not just the working classes or poor who suffer from globalization's negative effects, because as Baker pointed out in one of his old books or articles, if it truly were just the 1% versus the 99%, there'd be absolutely no legitimacy and no one would defend the system. However, between that 1% and so-called 99%, you have this, I'd say maybe 9 or 10% of affluent, comfortable professionals. And I think if these affluent, comfortable professionals start to suffer from the effects of market discipline, it could provide a real political spark for reforming our political economy now that everyone's struggling.
And I've noticed that even personally with dissident politics, when I first got exposed to things maybe back in 2008, around 2010, I noticed a tendency of people being more from working class backgrounds, but I've noticed a big rise in the number of people in well-educated backgrounds whose parents are upper middle class involved in dissident politics. I've noticed a big increase.
Right, and it's not too surprising because, especially if you're a young millennial, you were told by your parents to go study hard, do well in school, and that way you'll find a high-paying job. Then, of course, the whole bait and switch takes place, and there aren't that many high-paying jobs unless you're skilled and lucky enough to find a way in tech. So I think because of these thwarted expectations, we're going to see more anger among well-educated people.
And with the tech industry, I mean, those H-1B visas that you wrote an article about, that H-1B reform and that Congresswoman Zoe Lefgren, that's mm-hmm. something that has a negative effect on the upper middle class as well.
Right, well, a specific segment of the upper middle class. And again, to reiterate, I sympathize with those who lose their jobs, and I don't want them to suffer. But at the same time, we shouldn't cry for displaced tech workers any more than we would for displaced manufacturing workers. So I think the real approach should not be to just attack H-1Bs, but find a way to overhaul our political economy and look after all Americans.
Pilliter, do you want to comment?
No, that's pretty interesting, though.
Yeah, economics can be surprisingly interesting. Well, at least read certain sources.
Well, Michael Hudson primarily focuses on the passive rentier income in the forms of a land and rent capital gains. Baker zeroes on how rents arise from market imperfections and anti-competitive behavior. Can you explain sort of the key fundamental differences between his argument and Hudson's?
Okay, so basically when Michael Hudson talks about economic rent, he's thinking of some landlord who's basically sitting on his ass and doing nothing but collecting money from either his tenants or from rising land values. Basically, it's income that requires no real effort or creativity whatsoever. Ditto for bankers lending money at interest or natural resource owners charging monopoly toll booth fees. However, in the case of professionals, I mean, you take doctors, dentists, lawyers, no one's saying that they're lazy. They work hard, they provide a valuable service, but nevertheless, they make more money than they should because of market distortions that artificially limit their supply and allow them to monopolize certain services. So when Dean Baker speaks of economic rent, he's sort of referring to a competitive advantage that the sort of working rentiers are collecting.
And you mentioned that with allowing nurses and a dental hygienist to perform a lot of the tasks that doctors and dentists do. One other thing is there's this state legislature in Montana, Jerry O'Neill, and he's a good friend of Charles Lincoln, and Charles interviewed him on this show. And Jerry O'Neill is an advocate of abolishing the monopoly on legal licenses and allowing paralegals to perform legal tasks.
Right. I mean, just take the drafting of a will or a simple contract, for example. Do we really need lawyers to perform that task? I mean, it's just writing some documents. We could get a paralegal to do it. So Baker definitely thinks that we should allow these lower paid professionals to sort of expand the scope of services they can perform.
Baker points out that companies are always looking for ways to reduce labor costs and increase efficiency.
I mean, just look at the job stats. During the so-called Obama recovery, 94% of all new jobs were temporary or part-time jobs. So you can see the way companies are using temps as a way to avoid paying benefits, keeping salaries low, keeping hourly wages low. So they're always looking for ways to increase their bottom line. And also, your regular worker could not screw up at their jobs and get away with it. At the very least, if a regular worker screwed up, he'd be reprimanded, he'd be expected to do better on penalty of either unfavorable scheduling or termination. And yet that doesn't happen for those at the higher echelons.
And Baker also argues that shareholders don't really wield that much influence. He actually advocates that the shareholders should be able to vote on the CEO's wages. I remember when Dota wrote that article on national capitalism, he posted that chart that shows worker to CEO disparities by developed nations. And the United States, that gap is far greater than any other prosperous nation, whether it's like Germany or Japan. It's absurd. But his Baker solution to the CEO page, the CEO wages, is to have the shareholders vote on it. Why do you think it's more crucial to have the shareholders vote on it than, say, the workers? That would be probably the latter would be probably what Marxists would prefer.
Well, I do know that in certain companies, I mean, certain countries such as Germany, union representatives actually act as shareholders and board members to an extent. and that there's more of a stakeholder capitalism in those countries. So I'm definitely not opposed to having workers play some role in determining CEO pay. But I guess what Baker's saying is that it's important to have either shareholders or somebody else tackle CEO pay, because left to their own devices, they're always going to award themselves high paychecks. And it's kind of
screws up the shareholders' economic profits, their incentives to invest in a company.
Well, unfortunately, might not be how much you think, because as people like Ha-Jun Chang have pointed out, worst comes to worst, shareholders can always sell their stock at a loss, a little bit of a loss, and then move on. But shareholders, as Baker pointed out, are by and large comprised of these free-floating individuals, and so it's kind of hard to organize them and make them really care about the long-term viability of a company.
One other thing you touch upon in this article is the pharmaceutical monopolies.
Yes.
What do you think about Trump's proposal to let people buy insurance across state lines? And I think he even said something I think he even flirted with the idea of the government negotiating cost of medication, but it's hard to tell what he's going to do.
Well, that seems to be the recurring problem with Trump. He's kind of a wild card. You never really know what you're going to get. But if he were to actually follow through on his promise and mandate that the federal government can negotiate drug prices with pharmaceutical companies, and if he were to allow people to purchase insurance across state lines, that would be great. And in fact, even left-wing journalist Matt Taibbi, in one of his articles, noted that the McCarran-Ferguson Act, the 1945 act that allows insurers to basically divvy up states, is indefensible, and it should be tackled.
So Trump's proposal during the election basically would be to allow people to buy insurance across state lines.
Right, and if he followed through on that, that would be great, but only time will tell.
So you conclude this argument in how to rig the market in our favor. What are some of the key conclusions that you came to from reading this book?
Well, in a nutshell, we should basically force people on top to endure the same hardships that regular people have been enduring for the past four decades or so. And to clarify, this is not about vindictively picking on affluent, happy professionals just to bring them down to our level, but rather, as Baker points out, subjecting professionals to market discipline and forcing them to really compete will result in high savings for the rest of us. And I think Baker estimated that just by curbing doctor pay and allowing for more medical competition, the average family could save over $700 a year, which in today's America is increasingly not chump change. And then you also factor in the money we could save by paying fewer dollars for patent-protected items, copyright-protected items, dental services, etc. And so it's really important to sort of eliminate rent-seeking and to ensure that other people cannot practice what he calls selective protectionism.
This ties in with what you said in your Hudson review. But basically, what you said is instead of framing the argument in a sense of justice, fairness, equality, just sort of debunking, the crucial thing is to debunk the neoliberal claim that inequality penalizes enterprising winners and rewarding losers.
Right, because it's not just the free market doing its work and performing its magic and somehow certain people are becoming enormously wealthy. No, these people are becoming wealthy by and large because of either government policies designed to redistribute income or because of basically acting in a predatory, rent-seeking fashion. I mean, take two of the world's wealthiest men, Bill Gates and Carlos Slim, for example, and Baker doesn't talk about Gates in Rigged, but he does in some of his other articles and books. But Gates became rich in large part because of copyright laws that allowed him to charge monopoly prices for his products, and also because of anti-competitive behavior. I believe the Justice Department even brought an antitrust suit against Gates. Or if you look at Carlos Slim, the way he made his fortune was by basically monopolizing Mexico's telecom market and charging exorbitant fees. He did nothing to add to enhance society's wealth or produce any value. He just used his property claim to enrich himself at everyone else's expense.
You also have a disclaimer at the end of your article. Before anyone reads this post, they shouldn't conclude that you've transformed into some ardent open borders supporter and globalist.
No, and I haven't. But the point I'm trying to make is that the reason why I think you have so many of these, what the alt-right would call either wimpy white liberals or conservative cucks, is because these people basically comprise the bulk of the affluent managerial professional class, and so they have no reason to upend the status quo since they're doing so well. What I want to do is subject these people to market discipline as well and make them feel the pressures of globalization. Basically, when Zach Buchamp or Matt Iglesias' job can be outsourced or replaced by a foreigner, then I'll be happy. But that doesn't mean I want open borders by any means.
And I like how you posted that Seinfeld clip under your H-1B article, where one where George says, living in a society.
Oh yeah, that's one of his more funny lines one of his more funny recurring lines throughout the series. But yes, I think it behooves me to remind people that we do live in a society, despite all of the individualistic entrepreneurial rhetoric. And in a society, people should have obligations to one another, and, you know, companies should actually look after American interests rather than just blindly pursuing profits above all else. There's no longer this sense of stewardship among our business elites.
You also wrote about Winston Churchill on land monopolies, and Winston mm-hmm. Churchill actually did write about a lot of the themes of Michael Hudson's Killing the Host. And what's right. interesting is there's a lot of angles you can get at, but people tend to judge someone, but like there's the GDP, the average income, but that doesn't take into account the amount of money that goes into rents and right. property costs. And Winston Churchill, even back then, was talking about this issue.
I mean, just look at the Bay Area, for example. Technically, the Bay Area has been booming. You know, the GDP's high, more tax revenues flowing in. You have all these new tech startups. And yet, for the average person in the Bay Area, their standard of living has not improved. Rents continue to soar. People have to pay more and more for insurance. Well, that's not particular to the Bay Area, but still. And most of the gains from the so-called boom have gone to the top 1%. So the average person in the Bay Area has nothing to show for increases in the GDP.
I mean, where you are, is there really any remnants of a middle class, or is it just kind of this society where you have the ultra-wealthy tech elites, the rank-and-file tech workers crammed into small apartments, and then the kind of lumpen proletariat of, like, illegal immigrants and, like, the service sector?
Yeah, that's quite a dystopian vision, but I don't know. One of these days we might have a scenario that unfolds in Kurt Vonnegut's satirical novel Player Piano, where you have this small elite of scientists, engineers, and a managerial class, and then everyone else is basically given make-work jobs and barely get by. But I would say at least in the Bay Area, you do have a middle class, don't get me wrong, but increasingly you have this wealthy elite, then you have about a small but noticeable minority of affluent professionals, and then everyone else is just scraping by. And in fact, I even read that a full third of Bay Area residents have contemplated moving due to living expenses.
Did you see that article I sent you?
I did.
What was your take on it?
Well, I mean, I think it's a little off topic, but, well, I mean, it was about Alicia Silverstone, who apparently attended San Mateo High, but, I mean, I guess it really just goes to show how, I think San Mateo also produced Tom Brady. I believe he went to Sarah.
So, Peter Thiel.
Oh, Peter Thiel, that guy. So, I mean, San Mateo is right in the is near the heart of Silicon Valley, so.
Do you think if they went to high school at the same time, she could have turned him straight?
Well, if she looked like she did in Clueless, she might have a chance, but I think his politics would remain fundamentally unchanged.
Oh, I think she did endorse Dennis Kucinich for president.
Dennis Kucinich.
And Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I guess she goes for more of the social democracy angle.
You voted for Bernie Sanders, so you have that in common.
I did. Mm-hmm. I'm probably the only person who inhabits my fringe corner of the blogosphere who did actually vote for Bernie Sanders.
Just accumulating, thinking about all these things. Like, I was looking up Carlos Slim and looking up his wealth and what he's being. I just think it's crazy how he has that much wealth, and just especially in Mexico, it seems. Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Right, and another thing about Carlos Slim that's worth mentioning is that you'll see various randroids and neoliberal apologists say, oh, well, you know, he still deserves his wealth, and hey, the rich spend their money into the economy, and you can't infringe on freedom or some other nonsense. But if you're actually a committed capitalist who believes in business, you of all people should be opposed to Carlos Slim, because guess what? In order to conduct business, people often need to make telephone calls. And since Carlos Slim is price gouging people for telephone services with his monopoly, it actually raises the cost of doing business and hampers businesses' competitiveness. So this rent seeking is bad for capitalism. And the classical economists such as Adam Smith thought as much.
Does Michael Hudson, did he propose turning telephone companies into public utilities, and same with banks?
Right. He did. And Michael Hudson even quotes Cleveland's mayor from the early 20th century, who once said something to the effect that either you own the utilities or they own you. Unless utilities, infrastructure, etc., are nationalized and turned into public commodities, then they'll be privatized and used for rent seeking, and basically the country will become a toll booth economy.
What are some of the other crucial things that Winston Churchill said about land monopolies in the article you wrote?
Well, I think the most important thing he said was that any economic improvements will be used as a pretext to hike rents. So, as he put it, if wages rise, then rents can rise accordingly because people can afford to pay a little more. And he also mentioned the story of how people who crossed the Thames to get to work had to pay a toll, and eventually the toll was removed to everyone's delight. But then, lo and behold, not too long after, landlords start charging more because people can afford to pay more. And it just sort of illustrates how, unless kept in check, these landlords and other fire sector parasites, no, it sounds like a strong word, but yes, parasites will continue to collect, sort of reap all economic gains for themselves.
Michael Hudson did write an article about Trump's infrastructure plan, saying it's developer welfare. And I kind of have a nuanced take on this, but I get his fundamental argument. His argument is that infrastructure projects like subways, and I think he was referring to a new subway line on the Upper East Side,
right,
in particular, they drive up the cost of real estate, and that benefits the real estate owners and real estate developers, and that's being subsidized by the taxpayers. What's your take on that? And I'll kind of offer my take, which is a nuanced take.
Well, I agree with Hudson because he also cites the example of Vancouver, where taxpayer money was used to fund public projects, and in turn, landlords use that as an excuse to raise rents. So basically, taxpayers are subsidizing landlords, which is why I think we should levy a land value tax. And as I've seen some people say, calling it a tax is misleading because we're not really taxing landlords so much as making them give back to society what society handed them in the first place.
So my take on this is I think it's crucial to have a cohesive subway system. I think it's crucial to have a subway system to have cohesive urbanism. And obviously our whole society based on the car-oriented single-family home model, it's not sustainable. I mean, maybe back in the 50s when you had when land was more plentiful and we had the baby boom and people were starting families, I mean, it made sense at the time, but in hindsight, it hasn't really worked out. And the problem is we have a situation in California where you have a lot of older rich people owning single-family homes and young people either living at home or living in apartments with roommates. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, our population's increasing through mass immigration, but we're not really addressing the housing shortage to keep up with that. So that puts further strain. And mass transit allows people to be independent from cars, but it also allows increase in housing supplies. So I think it is crucial to have a mass transit if you want to have functional urbanism. But at the same time, it should be subsidized either by a tax on the wealthiest landowners or a financial transaction tax like a Tobin tax instead of just taxing the regular the general fund, or some kind of a public infrastructure bank that funds infrastructure projects. And Ellen Brown, who I've interviewed, she put out that idea of a public infrastructure bank. So my basically take is I disagree. So my nuanced take in this is I disagree with Hudson that infrastructure projects are by themselves are inherently bad. I think we do need mass transit. I just think the key issue is how do you fund these projects? Guy, what's your take on that?
Well, I wouldn't say that Hudson thinks that infrastructure projects are bad in and of themselves. It depends on the infrastructure and for whose benefit. And I think what Hudson's saying is that we have to reform the market in a way that doesn't allow landlords to capture all of the gains, and that doesn't allow them to use improvements as an excuse to price gouge. And I definitely think infrastructure can be vital, but as Dota told me in one of our conversations, given that the U.S. has ceased to really be a manufacturing power, what would the point of a nationwide infrastructure project really be, since the U.S. is not exactly transporting a ton of manufactured goods? So I think that
one of the things is building new highways. It subsidizes Walmart and all these big box stores, and I mean that's a big problem. He points out specifically to the Lexington Avenue line, which is a proposed subway line that would benefit some of the wealthiest parts of New York City. Mm-hmm. My observation living in LA has been that mass transit lines have been built traditionally in the lower income areas, But there's been this opposition in a lot of the wealthier areas. What happened was there was a proposed subway line that was going to connect downtown LA to Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. And Congressman Henry Waxman, who represents all the wealthy areas on the west side, like Beverly Hills and Santa Monica, he blocked that line back in the 80s, citing that there was some kind of danger because it went near the La Brea tar pits. But a lot of the wealthy people in that area, I mean, they're the same people who are dependent on all that cheap labor. But right. There's this kind of hypocrisy that they didn't want the subway bringing in all the riffraff into their areas.
Well, I mean, there's this funny Simpsons episode where Homer, in response to an airport being built near his neighborhood where planes would fly over his home daily, lobbies against that and actually gets involved in politics. And eventually, through Homer and the Simpsons agitation, the airport is built elsewhere. And Homer triumphantly says, "Now planes are flying over where they're supposed to, over the homes of poor people."
Huh.
So it's kind of the same principle, you know, that NIMBY mindset. That's also quite prevalent in the Bay Area, I should add, because
that was an issue with the high-speed rail going through the peninsula, and also I think peninsula has also blocked the BART line as well.
Yeah, I do notice that. I think that BART extends as far south as Millbrae in the peninsula, and after that you have to use Caltrain. But regarding the Bay Area, one other thing I wanted to bring up, which is interesting since we were talking about immigration earlier, is that even though people in the Bay Area obviously are rather liberal, when it comes to the refugee question, despite supporting a welcoming attitude towards refugees on paper, residents of San Francisco did not want actual refugees housed near them, so it is definitely that NIMBY, let somebody else deal with it mentality.
And I remember a while back, you linked to that Steve Saylor article, San Francisco's whitening plan. And I think the demographic trends from my observation is that the Bay Area is becoming more Asian. But
oh, yes.
One of the factors was that the high prices in San Francisco and even Oakland are pushing out a lot of the black population and Hispanics to a degree as well.
Right, because just consider that in 1970, blacks comprised around 13% of SF's population. And today, they represent less than 6% of the city's population. And that's kind of interesting because in the aftermath of Trump's victory, there was some liberal white woman tech CEO type, I don't know if you heard about this, who on Twitter basically blasted these working class whites in the Rust Belt, saying that, you know, if you want good jobs, then you have to reform your attitudes and be more tolerant because businesses aren't going to want to do business with a bunch of backward, in so many words, hicks like you. And some people on the pro-socialist Jacobin left actually criticized her, saying that you do realize that San Francisco has fewer, that black people are fewer than 6% of SF's population, right? And that SF is not amazingly diverse. So I think there's definitely a lot of hypocrisy in the city.
Do you see it as crucial and viable of is having a strong urban middle class? It seems to be the kind of the trend of income inequality is nationwide, but it's most felt in major metropolitan areas like SF, LA, New York City, Miami, Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And
for what it's worth, I think SF's rank on the inequality list actually dropped a bit.
That's interesting.
Now it's no longer number two.
Huh. What's number one, New York?
I think it might still be Atlanta, but now I think Boston and Miami and some of the other, D.C., of course, and some of the other cities have eclipsed SF, but I don't have the exact list at my disposal at the moment.
And the thing is, I mean, there's the job factor, that there's a decline in middle class jobs, and that's happening nationwide. A lot of these tech jobs basically are middle class jobs, and if we didn't have the whole H-1B visa thing, we could be providing a lot of good middle class jobs. Then that gets us to the issue of housing, that there's not enough housing. So then we would have to have, I don't think the free market is really enough. We would have to have this sort of a massive government plan to build massive amounts of middle class housing in the urban areas. And then the other factor is schools, and I think busing has destroyed a lot of the urban schools in the Bay Area. I think you mentioned that. That's one of the issues that kind of got you exposed to these issues.
Busing? I don't know if I really mentioned busing specifically, but I will say that you said that it's important for urban areas to have a strong middle class to thrive. And indeed, it's true, because eventually, if housing becomes so unaffordable and if regular people can't live in the city, then who's going to work at all of these good jobs? How are tech companies going to be able to keep employees if employees can't afford to live in their vicinity? I mean, are we eventually going to become a nation of hour-plus commuters throughout the country? And that's why, to go back to the land value tax, I think the reason why a land value tax would be so vital is because, as Hudson argues, it would keep the value of property down because, one, it would discourage hoarding and speculation, and two, it would also leave less money to be pledged to the banks as interest. And as we all know from our previous show, one of the main reasons why assets soar in price is because of banks lending money against them. So I think that a land value tax would be huge.
Especially on people who own multiple homes. There's a lot of wealthy Chinese buying up homes in the Bay Area and just leaving them empty as investments in case their economy collapses. Same with the Saudis. I was also reading that in Paris, they're talking about putting a massive tax on two people who own a third home in the city. And that makes sense.
Yeah, and I absolutely applaud such efforts because there's no real reason why these absentee landlords should be able to just hoard property and reap the gains for essentially doing nothing and contributing nothing to society. So now, with regards to taxing land, don't get me wrong. If a landlord wants to make improvements on their own land, if they want to maybe start a business on their land, then that's fine. We're not going to penalize that. But if you're just hoarding land and taking advantage of society's general prosperity and collecting land rent, then that's not going to fly in my book.
And back to what I was saying, I think for your next article, it should be how to build a cohesive urban middle class. And I'll just give you kind of the basics that we went over. Preserving what good middle class jobs that we have, addressing the housing issue, both the FIRE economy aspects, ultra wealthy people and financial interests hoarding real estates, finding ways to increase the supplies of housing, and also making it reforming education, because that's a factor. A lot of families leave urban areas because of the school. So I think
mine was among them.
Yeah.
I was actually born in SF, if you must know.
And I went to public school in LA. I've had some more experiences. I mean, I lived in LA most of my life, but I think for your next article, I think that's a good topic.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, at the moment, I'm working on an article where I trash health insurance and the insurance industry because I've written before about finance and real estate, but now it's insurance's turn to be on the chopping block and their predatory behavior, because hey, there is an eye in FIRE, so I figure it's about time I write about insurance.
Are you advocating making them into like a public utility?
Well, to an extent, but well, at least definitely with private health insurance. Yeah, no question about that. And I'm actually going to use a clip from HBO's crime series, The Sopranos, to illustrate my point. So stay tuned.
What do you think about the whole like Swiss model of healthcare? A lot of people put that out there as an alternative where it's private insurance, but the government sets the rates.
Well, I wouldn't have too many objections to that because in just about every other country in the world, the government either sets the rates or they manage to negotiate prices with pharmaceutical companies. Whereas in the U.S., health insurers, medical providers, big pharma, they can basically just charge whatever the hell they feel like, and that should certainly not be permitted.
Barry, a guy, you did touch briefly on the whole SJW riots at UC Berkeley, and you also talked about Robert Reich's response to that, because you reviewed his book, Saving Capitalism.
I did, and to think I once had respect for the man. Just kidding, to an extent, but yeah, it is kind of interesting to see how liberals have devolved into this, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, wingnut paranoia, because for years, liberals would always mock the right by calling them wingnuts, saying that they indulge in conspiracy theories. I mean, I remember when the birther controversy came out, liberals would never let conservatives hear the end about it. Oh, look at how stupid and irrational you are. And yet, look at liberals now. You have people like Robert Reich postulating that Milo set up the riots himself. Somehow, in a place like Berkeley, you have all the Russia hysteria, everyone freaking out whenever they hear the word Russia attached to Trump somehow. And liberals, in many ways, have sort of shown their true colors, and they've sort of nullified the claim that they're these rational, facts-governed people.
And there is this trend towards legitimization of political violence. I know when Richard Spencer got attacked, a lot of prominent liberal news outlets defended the guy, or they pondered the question, is it legitimate to punch Nazis?
Right, and what's interesting is that some people on the left have actually pushed back against that argument. For example, Lee Fang of The Intercept and even Noam Chomsky, because Chomsky basically said in so many words that, look, if political violence were to ever erupt, the most brutal guys would win. And let's face it, that's not us. And Hunter Wallace and other people on the alt-right have pointed out that, you know, the right wing is a lot more heavily armed than the left wing. And I think Glenn Greenwald even pointed that out. And so I think the left should really be careful what it wishes for. And in fact, some Antifas have even been brutally attacked by skinhead types. I think I recently read a New York Post article about
Sacramento.
Actually, not Sacramento, but recently around the New York area where a couple of Antifas were brutally attacked by a couple of skinheads. So
there's also Gavin McInnes's Proud Boys, which is basically a reaction to the Antifa, but basically the street type, but being proud for civil nationalism and shutting up Antifa and crazy liberals. And so I don't know if there's really going to be some kind of SS for the alt-right, or at least some Antifa equivalent, but it's often flirted about. And certainly if street, you know, politics happen more often, I don't know. I keep the street hooligan activity to aside because I really think it's petty.
I absolutely agree, and I'm firmly against violence. But if the left continues to indulge in this kind of behavior, then I think they're barking up the wrong tree, because it's not just the alt-right, mind you. Even regular Trump supporters have been attacked, and you now have people saying that any white person who says racist stuff or is too conservative or libertarian might be fair game. And so,
well, they'll say stuff that because the alt, they literally believe that the people like Trump, Bannon, Milo, and obviously Richard Spencer are promoting genocide and ethnic cleansing, that it's morally justified to counter them with violence. That's what they believe, which is absurd.
Well, it is absurd. I mean, it flies against all the free speech traditions of the U.S., but also at some point that logic could be turned against them. And I think Ramsey Paul once pointed out that, you know, in America, we have a tradition of punching communists. So if I think you're a communist because you're too liberal or leftist, does that mean I can punch you? So again, I think liberals and leftists who support punching Nazis, real or imagined, might want to step back and rethink things a bit.
Bay Area Guy, I would like to thank you for being on. It's been an excellent show, covered a lot of really crucial topics.
Yeah, as always, it's great being on here. I think it was a very fruitful discussion.
And also, thanks, Pillator.
Awesome talking to you.
Yeah, always good to chat.